For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging.
Our role as thinking sentient beings is to see what we can do to reduce our contribution, and that's probably where my concern is, that we seem to abrogate that responsibility, and there's no other species on the planet that can do what we can do. Now, we can cause things, but we also have the capacity to change things and to improve things, and that's one of the dismays I have when I look at those people that say that there is no role for us to reverse or change anything, and in fact, if not us, who will? Who can?
Professor George Breitberg AM is Professor of Emergency Medicine at Royal Melbourne Hospital and the University of Melbourne, and he's the Emergency Medicine Head of the Centre for Integrated Critical Care Medicine. George has written a perspective for the MJA about climate change and how we can think about and respond to it through the lens of disaster medicine. He is my special guest today.
There is a growing sense that climate change, through its effect on the environment, is going to impact on healthcare. And we already have seen that anyway when you talk about what's happening in Australia with the bushfires and the floods. You just have to think about what's going on now in America and Southwest due to Hurricane Ian. And again, not only are their lives lost and doctors have to deal with the fact that there is mortality, morbidity associated with a climactic event, but it's also the longer term patient burden. That yes. Vulnerability thing I write about, where if someone has survived this, they might survive the initial incident or the initial event. But then if they're on a CPAP machine and there's no electricity, if they have chronic disease, if they need to get to appointments, if they lose their transportation, if they lose that connectedness with their healthcare providers, then the post-event or post-incident healthcare burden continues to increase. And we sort of know that, you know, whenever there is an environmental disaster or environmental change, the healthcare burden increases, and we just have to think about what's happened with COVID-19 and where we are at the moment with the increasing burden on healthcare and hospitalizations. And as an emergency physician, I see this every day when I'm coming to the emergency department and the consequences of that. So I think for the skeptics, it's pretty hard to walk away from now. I think we see it, and most people are getting that connection between what is happening in our environment through climate change and what is happening in our workplaces.
Are disasters happening more frequently, or are we just better at being aware of them?
No, they're happening more frequently. By every measure, every publication, they're happening much more frequently than they were. And again, when you think about what the driver of that is, whilst there is increasing exposure of humans by, you know, more access to transportation, there's more air travel, etc., overwhelmingly it's due to the fact that we have these environmental disasters that keep coming that are related to the fact that we've got increasing warming in our oceans. We've got increasing changes in the way vectors transmitting diseases, and that's all in response to climate changes. So I don't think it's that we're better at measuring it, although there probably is a small bit of that. We're certainly more aware of it, but there is definitely more of it.
In your article, you talk about that frequency increasing for a lot of different reasons. And obviously, factors of climate change are part of that, you know, higher temperatures, higher ocean temperatures, atmospheric changes, etc. What effect does human behaviour have? What have we done to increase the occurrence of those disasters?
I guess the short answer to that question, our role as thinking sentient beings is to see what we can do to reduce our contribution. And that's probably where my concern is, that we seem to abrogate that responsibility. And there's no other species on the planet that can do what we can do. Now, we can cause things, but we also have the capacity to change things and to improve things. And that's one of the dismays I have when I look at those people that say that there is no role for us to reverse or change anything. And in fact, if not us, who will? Who can? So I think our contribution is, whether you want to argue the percentages of our contribution, to me it's irrelevant. Our contribution is that we are the people, we are the sole beings on this planet that can do something about it.
At the moment, there's no declaration of a climate emergency at the federal level of government. What difference would that kind of declaration make in terms of our ability to deal with those disasters?
So it's a really good question. You need to define a hazard so then you can put in all the preventative strategies to reduce or mitigate its risk. And what strikes me when I think about that is that, for example, there is no agreed definition of terrorism. When you think about that, then that means that as a global community, we don't have an agreed way in which we can manage terrorism and reduce the risk of terrorism. That's been played out across the world, as we've seen. And so I think that if we don't define the hazard, if we don't all agree what a climate emergency is, then we don't have universal agreement on how best to tackle it. That's a fundamental problem that we currently have.
Would that sort of declaration also free up resources?
Once you've declared an emergency, then you have all the infrastructure and changes that are required to be able to deal with that emergency. So the first part is to recognise it, and the second part then is to start mobilising resources to manage or reduce the risk of it.
You also talk about a perfect storm approaching. Mm. What do you mean by that?
The world is tired. Yes. We're all a bit fatigued. It's incorrect to use the term, but I like to use the term. I think COVID-19 is a chronic disaster. It's one in which we are still living in, but which has its waves, but that resilience that we have as a community waxes, and I think we all see that around us. In addition, when we add to that the bushfires that we had just prior to the onset of COVID-19, the floods that occurred in Lismore during COVID-19, the fact that we've got another La Nina and El Nino effect happening, so that we're going to have the same sort of climate cycle coming up in the next calendar year. We are a community that has been stretched, and our resources have been stretched. And as I make the point, and we see it still played out in Hurricane Ian as something that's on our doorstep at the moment, it's the vulnerable populations who already start with the least resilience that are the ones that are going to be feeling the impact much more so than those that have got mobility or those that have got resources to be able to sustain their resilience. I think that overwhelming fatigue that is being felt that prevents people from, or it's just another step that people have to overcome before they then think about getting their lives back in order after they've suffered a disaster. With that increasing frequency that you mentioned before, there is less time between disasters to be able to recover appropriately. And that's also going to impact on the ability of people to face the next disaster and get their lives back in order as best they can.
I'm chatting today with Professor George Breitberg from Royal Melbourne Hospital and the University of Melbourne. His MJA article is free to access, and the full link is available in the show notes to this podcast. You can catch up with our back catalogue of episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts. To subscribe to coming episodes, search for Medical Journal of Australia on your favourite podcast platform and hit the subscribe button. We recommend Spotify and Apple Music. Back to our chat. What would you like to see happen in the short term to get us more prepared for the next wave of whatever disaster it is, whether that's COVID or floods or whatever?
So I think the first thing is to acknowledge that we're in a climate emergency.
Yeah.
And as we talked about, that means that there would be a recognition. We would stop the sort of second sideline conversations that go on about whether it's real or not. Let's just face the fact that it's real. Mm-hmm. And then we can allocate resources to it. I think we need to, as a community, think how our least resilient and most vulnerable people need to be able to have the resources to cope and ensure that we've got good social infrastructures to be able to support them. And I think if we can, as has been said many times before, as if we're a community that cares for our most vulnerable, then we're a community that will care for those that have got the most resilience. You know, I think about Hurricane Katrina, where there was lots of knowledge about the structure of the levee being below the flood line, and that resources were diverted away from fixing that problem to other infrastructure programs that probably didn't have the same need, but which had sort of political, social necessities. And so
do you see that sort of thing happening here now?
Some of the policy is opaque, so we don't really know. That's where once you declare the climate emergency and you can start to look at the policy framework underpinning it, then you can make sure that you do look after those most vulnerable populations. But currently it's a little bit opaque. And that's both within a country and across country. The South Pacific Islands that are going to be prone to flooding, how is a global community supporting them? If you think about Japan, which is subject to earthquakes quite frequently, as a more first order country, if you like, with more resources, they've been able to adopt their building codes so that they can have buildings that sway in the wind rather than those that collapse. Within Australia and across the globe, we just need to make sure that we're looking after those that don't have the resources to be able to show that resilience and response is necessary. Yeah. You know, I want to sort of talk about the impact as a result of the hazard, and the hazards we've talked about are increasing in frequency, and we sort of know what they're going to be. We've talked a lot about the vulnerability, and then the mitigating processes is to look at the preparation and then the recovery and then the resilience. And so really it's about preparation. What are the things that good government needs to put into place to prepare for these events? And that means that we've got both to look at our forests, and we need to, as we do for bushfire seasons, make sure that we clear things away from houses so that we minimize the property damage. We need to look at having, as we do now in Victoria, making sure that every family has a plan A and a plan B when there's a fire risk. We need to make sure that we have the response that's appropriate so that we do have our emergency services coordinated and that we do have that command and control structure readily available to be implemented immediately when the need arises. And I think we do pretty well with that in that regard in Australia. And certainly we've learned from our bushfire experience and become much tighter in that response. And then, as I said, look at community resilience and recovery and make sure that after there's a devastating event that we have really good teams that go in to manage not just the loss of property and life, but the psychological stressors and getting people back onto their feet financially and giving them back their dignity as well, because that's one of the things that is a long-term problem. And I think we do have teams and we have learned, but I think we can do a little bit better. I know that from the fires in the Macedon Ranges, there are still people that were living in caravans for a couple of years afterwards, and that response needs to be more timely. We need to learn that those communities get a lot of attention when the disaster is there. It's on the front page of the paper. Everyone is donating money, but it's the recovery that can take months to years that and it loses the sort of attention span of the community too quickly.
You also talk about climate change as a threat multiplier. What do you mean by that?
So again, there's a lot of communities, countries in the world that live on the edge, whether it's in Africa and they're already suffering from years of famine or recovering or going into another dry spell. And strong communities have good trust and faith in their government, and they rely on that trust and faith of the government to get them through the next incident, the next disaster. When that's lost, or when there's a subversive element that comes in and capitalizes on someone's vulnerability, then the system of governance can break down, and that's where the terrorist effect occurs. And we know that there has been that sort of spread of terrorism in those vulnerable communities, and that in itself then causes an incredibly disruptive effect on the capacity of the community to respond to the disaster, because funds are usually diverted to other socio-political aims. So it doesn't stop with saying this community has suffered from an earthquake. It's the ramifications of what happens during and after.
Increasing hardship leads to disgruntled people, doesn't it?
Correct. And disgruntled people often have every right to be disgruntled.
Absolutely.
Part of this is strengthening governance and government's response to their own people, and assisting governments in a way in which they can get resources to manage their communities rather than bring necessarily external teams in, do some of that response, then leave the country without a management plan. The emphasis really is that we have to define the hazard. And once we've agreed on a definition and once we've coordinated our efforts, then at least we're managing the beast that we know rather than this unknown entity that, as you said in the very beginning, there are still people that have a lot of airtime that disagree. And that needs to stop. We need to silence the skeptics so we can get on with the policy framework. The other thing too, I think one of the things I did mention and I cited and I quite like is that it's almost at that pivotal stage of stop using the word natural disaster and start talking about man-made and just emphasising that accountability we do have as a thinking species about you know, what we're doing to our own environment and what we need to do to fix our environment where possible.
Fantastic, George. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
That's okay.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.